Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Kind Ethics, the show that helps you manage your life and your health. I am Vicki Kind, your host. I am a medical ethicist and a personal healthcare strategist. I am also the creator of the Kind Method for making ethical medical decisions. I really am so happy you're here today.
And you too. I'm Francis Shawnee Parker. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. First off, I just want to say your book is so beautiful. I love the poetic way you put the patient's suffering into words.
Thank you.
It's just, I've read a lot of medical narrative literature, and the stories are beautiful, and then all of a sudden you just say it in a way that's like, wow, it kind of makes you catch your breath. So I'm very glad to have read your book,
not only
for the stories, but for the wisdom as well. Have you always been a poet, or have these experiences really have made you put voice to the meaning?
No, I've always been interested in writing, and I've always been interested in poetry. Even when I was a child, I always wrote. So, basically, I'm a writer, and so I don't know if you write, but if you're right, you really don't have a choice. You're going to write because the stories, whatever it is, it stays in your mind until you do put it to paper. So I saw a lot of things going on in the nursing homes, and so I naturally started writing and then reading, because I also participated in a lot of poetry readings. That's when I found out so many people were interested in that because they needed more information.
Do you know if your book is being used for medical schools? I know medical school training now includes something called medical humanities.
Right.
Where doctors and nurses, everyone is educated in listening to the patient's story.
Right. I've spoken to quite a few healthcare groups that included especially nurses, but also social workers and doctors. So I've been invited by several groups to speak, so I know that there is an interest in it in the healthcare field.
Oh, excellent. Yeah.
And also hospice groups.
Oh, yeah, hospice would love the book. I know that that you've been working a lot in urban nursing homes, and they have similar needs to all nursing homes, but especially in underprivileged areas. What do you think are some of their specific needs, or what needs to be given voice to?
Well, I always say that the health care, the quality of it in any area, whether you're in a nurse, whether you're a patient at home, whether you're in an institution, it's always going to be judged on the context that is given. And that context would include what kind of staff is there, where it's located, in many cases the racial ethnic background of the patients, and also the equipment and whatever the resources that are available. So all of these things play a part in whether a person has quality health care. So in an urban area that's particularly a low income area, that environment is going to be reflected in the healthcare. So then if you have a high degree of urban poverty, there will probably be a higher lack of resources to correct some of the situations that need to be corrected. And there may be a higher degree of racial ethnic minorities. There may be a higher degree of racial disparities to contend with. So the environment is going to be impacted by what goes on in the nursing home.
I know one thing that we face when we're working with hospice patients, because a lot of times as a volunteer we go into patients' homes, and there can be a great deal of discomfort if the hospice workers don't look like the family, if they're from another culture or race, and there can be a disconnect and a sense of mistrust. Do you find that in the nursing home facilities, or is because they're nursing homes people feel a little safer?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because actually hospice in general is very underutilized by people of color. And so there should be more of an outreach in terms of hiring people that are diverse, because the patients will be diverse. And so that kind of outreach, I think, is needed in order to make everybody have a comfortable experience. But, of course, there's a point where everybody should be able to get along with just the fact that they have people taking care of them. But I also want to mention the fact that hospice has to have more outreach and more variety of staff members, patients in general, and also be located in more communities, because the research shows that most hospice organizations are located in areas that have a higher education, higher income, and actually a younger population as opposed to an elderly population.
So these
are some of the things that need to be, you know, to work out in order to create that cultural diversity is to have more of that available and more outreach.
Right. I know that when I'm educating physicians on communicating about end-of-life issues, I'm always bringing up the issue that we've got to offer hospice to everybody,
right,
not just the white people, you know, not just the educated people. And the awareness is increasing. But a lot of doctors give me a lot of, you know, they say back to me, Vicki, I try to offer it, but a lot of these people don't want what I have to offer. I think a lot of times it's how you communicate it. I think a lot of times the doctors don't know how to phrase it in a way that's acceptable. Is there something I could teach the doctors that would help a person?
The first thing you can teach them, and this is something I've heard before, what you're saying, is there's a tendency to say, well, they don't trust us, so you know, what can we do? When actually, the trust that many people of color have in terms of the healthcare profession, not to say that's the only reason some may be reluctant, but that is one factor that's discussed quite a bit. It's a valid trust. I mean, the healthcare, racial, ethnic, and even regarding females, this is something that's recognized by the Centers for Disease Control and American Medical Association. So these disparities that are going on, they are real. And so historically, this has been a concern, but the solution to that problem is not on the people who've been victimized by it. It's on the healthcare system to make people feel that they are welcome. And it's not only a healthcare issue. I consider it a moral issue. And there should be more accountability in terms of having people become more welcome, presenting things in languages that they know, finding out what their input is and respecting it. There are all kinds of ways that you would do in any kind of a relationship to want to gain a person's trust. But sometimes I have heard people say, well, if they would trust us, maybe we could help them. And really the burden of getting people to trust is on the same system that created the distrust.
Oh, absolutely. We have a long ways to go to heal the wounds.
Well, we do. And you know why? Because a lot of people... and I've noticed this from working with different healthcare workers. A lot of people feel that this is something that the institution should take care of. You know, and they're thinking of it in terms of the higher levels, when actually each person in the organization is a part of the institution. So each person, everyone who works in that institution, has a responsibility to make people feel welcome, to have them interested in whatever it is that they're doing. It's each person's responsibility, not just something that the people up, you know, who are in the leadership, they should take care of this. And there should be more accountability.
Yes, I agree. And I like the phrase, make people feel welcome. Because to change course after you realize that the healthcare system can no longer cure your disease, but what we can do at this point is manage your suffering, keep you out of pain, you know, provide a peaceful and dignified death. You know, I want people to have that option. I want them to have hospice, whether it's in their home or in the nursing home facility.
Right.
They should have that. And I feel so, I do feel like it's a moral issue where everyone should have that opportunity. And when people either aren't being offered it or don't know that they should accept it, that concerns me greatly. That's why I'm talking about these issues.
And you know, that's so good that you're doing that, because sometimes there's a reluctance to talk about it. Some people would like to think, oh, this is something that goes on in the South, when actually the research shows that the racial segregation patterns in the Midwest, not the South, are the reason why you have black elderly people in the Midwest, in places like Detroit and Michigan, and any place in the Midwest. This is why they have a high likelihood of being in a poor quality nursing home. People want, you know, would like to think none of this goes on, you know, except in the South. Many people don't, even people who are victimized by it, don't even realize how critical it is in terms of, there's research to even show some medications like, pain medications are not as available in urban areas as they are in the suburbs. There's a lot of research to support everything I'm saying.
Yeah,
and it's just a matter of people wanting to first recognize that, hey, maybe I'm part of the problem. And a lot of times this is done unconsciously, because the research also shows that sometimes people operate, particularly in a stressful situation like a hospital, et cetera, they're operating without necessarily taking time to think about what they're saying. Many times you have decisions that are being made, and there's no person of color at the table. And so people make decisions, you know, based on the people who with their bringing, their backgrounds. And so you have situations where you have websites or actual buildings where you walk into a healthcare facility and there's no person of color hanging up on the wall. They're not in the brochure. The picture isn't on the website. And these are decisions that were probably made without even thinking that, oh, we don't have any people of color. Some people think about that, like you probably would think about it. But there are a lot of people who don't. And it's not that they're, you know, trying to be racist or anything. They're just, you know, they aren't representative of people sitting at a table making the decision that's going to be diverse, because the people at the table making it may not be thinking about diversity. They see themselves at there, so they don't think about there are other people who are being left out.
I mean, I go to a lot of different hospitals. I work with a lot of different groups. And the good news is that most people are not doing these things, neglecting certain populations on purpose.
Right, I agree.
Just not being sensitive to it. And the other thing I realize is that everything you're saying about the research is true. One thing that motivates physicians is to know that research exists which tells them that if you're an African American and come into the ER, you're not going to get the same kind of pain meds as someone who's white.
And the Latinos, too.
And so the good news is we now have the research, and so now we can change things. And things are changing. One thing that we're doing in California is we're integrating cultural education into all of our continuing medical education. So everything that we're talking about, whether you're talking about diabetes or heart disease, we're talking about culture, race, gender, all of the different social and economic things that affect patients. So the good news is things are changing, maybe not fast enough. And unfortunately, I don't think they're changing fast enough in the nursing homes.
Well, you know, and I agree with what you're saying about the education, but I think we have to, and we've been doing education through the years, and it's been going on through the years. I think we need to go beyond education now and actually have some real accountability
take place
in terms of seeing that things are implemented.
Yeah, it's time to make a change now. I've seen enough in nursing homes. I've had loved ones there. I've visited there enough. I'm done. I have to change things. So that's why I wanted you here. One thing I'm very interested in, because I think it would benefit both our children and our elders, is this whole idea of home-school partnership. So the nursing home, what you described in the book is that you had groups of kids that would come to the nursing home, not in an uncontrolled fashion. They were prepared for it. They knew what to expect. And they would come and visit, and each one would be mentored by an elder. Is that correct?
It could be done like that. What I was talking about, and it's interesting you mentioned California, because intergenerational partnerships, not intergenerational partnerships, but the word service learning, is a major part of many of the school curriculums in California. So, in fact, it's even a requirement in many places, and also Philadelphia and some other cities around the country. And service learning is classroom learning that meets community needs. And that's what I was doing at my school as principal, and every single classroom in the school, including special education classes, were all involved in service learning. Every child was doing service. It was the theme of the school. But as I said, it goes on in many, many cities, and it doesn't have to even be part of the curriculum to have an intergenerational partnership. Faith-based groups can do that, after-school programs, community youth programs. Anybody can create situations with intergenerational partnerships. But when it's actually a part of the curriculum where, for example, in fourth graders, fourth graders might learn how to write letters, and after they learn how to write a letter, then they would actually find a nursing home or a children's hospital somewhere, and they would actually write real letters to real people. When the learning is extended into the community, then it becomes service learning. And in the book, I emphasize I have a chapter called School Nursing Home Partnerships, because I saw myself as principal, plus there is research to support this, when the two generations came together, and in this case it was a nursing home setting, there is academic and affective improvement. The students do, the research shows, do get more benefits academically. They're more enthusiastic about learning, more about caring for other people, and they also have greater civic and political engagement. And I don't mean just young children. My school happened to be a pre-kindergarten through eighth grade, but also high school students and college students can benefit from intergenerational partnerships, because many times they need this for their service requirements, and it also exposes them to healthcare careers, which we all know is suffering now from they don't have enough people who are doing things, so they definitely could use more people going into that career.
Right. If a child doesn't see that a kind of career exists, they never can choose it.
Right.
They don't know that you could be something more than just a nurse. You could be a hospital administrator. You could be a respiratory therapist. Until
right.
they know of these things, how can they choose it?
And you know,
go ahead.
One
of the stories in your book, you were talking about the idea that before you took the kids in, you know, you taught them certain skills and what to expect, especially dealing with dementia patients and some of the strange things that you and I have seen in nursing homes, and that you had an exercise where they kind of wrote down like what their, you didn't call it a stereotype, what they expected to see when they got
right.
there. And then maybe you can tell me more about what happened either during that experience or after that experience.
Okay, what we did was, I really support research, because I think it's one thing to say, oh, the children did this and you know, they love people more and all, but when you're talking to school districts and funders and people like that, they want to see research, and I want to see it, and I think the parents want to see it. So what we did was we had pre- and post-tests that we gave them before they did these experiences. And in the pre-test, they were asked, you know, on a scale of, you know, good, you know, degrees of, you know, good up to not so good, how did they feel about certain things. And they made up the things they would be expecting. They thought the older people would be grouchy. They thought they would want to get into their business, if you can imagine somebody having business in the fifth grade. they had all of these ideas, expectations that they had about the people they would, and they really didn't know too much about people with dementia, period. So that was a really good vocabulary word for them. And, you know, and what I like about that so much is, this is a word they learned from firsthand experience watching people who had dementia, and it's not on the standardized test. It wasn't one of their spelling words. So they get so many other benefits when they do these kinds of things. And, of course, we always have reflection afterwards, and so when we get back to the school and talk about it, and then when they took that same test over again, for example, in some places where 98% see it, the people would be grouchy. That was down to like 0%.
Wow.
So we could see the percentages were really decreasing and the stereotypes were going away, and some of the areas that they had been negative about in the pre-test were very positive in the post-test in terms of the percentages rising. So we had documentation to show, and if nothing else, that's wonderful, because at a very early age, children start buying into some of those stereotypes about old people, and there's a lot of ageism in our society.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure you remember a time, too, when there was a lot more respect for elders,
mm-hmm.
and it seems to be deteriorating. And that's one reason why I felt strongly that the school needed to get involved more in that, because a lot of children are just not getting this at home anymore.
Right.
You know, we have a lot of young parents who don't know, and we just the parenting in general is not on the same in some cases.
I think we might need to do the same pre- and post-test with adults as well, because they have terrible stereotypes of what it means to age, what it means to die, what it means to live in a handicapped body. There's so many stereotypes out there, but a lot of times if we teach the children, they go home and teach the adults.
Right.
They can be the voice for all of this learning.
And you know, one thing they're doing is, I think it's called semi-sensory deprivation training, where you have people walk around with corn in their socks to see what it'd be like to be old and doing that, and riding in a wheelchair. You can put goggles on them and grease the lens so that it's blurry to see. This is how a lot of people look at the world in a nursing home, because another thing that enough vision checking is not done on a regular basis. So you have many people in nursing homes who really have poor vision and can't even really see the food on their plates. So there are ways that this can be simulated so other people can experience that and maybe have more sensitivity to what it's like when you can't hear or when, you know, the world is blurred.
I actually do that sensory training with doctors when I talk about improving their offices to help the geriatric patient.
That's wonderful.
Because they don't understand how many people don't just have one limitation as they age. They may have multiple ones.
Right.
And doing simple tasks may be beyond this person, and we need to get them help.
Right. That's great that you do that.
Oh, thank you. So can you... If I wanted to do something like this in my own community, I know we don't have a lot of time, but what would be my first action step? What could I practically go and do today to start this process?
To start which process?
To start one school and one nursing home to start maybe coming towards each other and doing some service learning.
Well, I would suggest If where are you located now?
Well, I'm in Los Angeles. So
you won't have any. Los Angeles is very big on service learning. Believe me, they are very well represented at the service learning conferences. So it will not be if you just call up the school district. I am positive they will be able to tell you some schools that are doing service learning, that are doing it well, and they probably have some intergenerational programs already in place.
Okay.
Because Los Angeles is very big on service learning. I think they have it required from first grade through 12th in their district.
Okay, so I can make sure that possibly I help keep moving that along and connecting
sure.
with schools.
It's
what
probably going along well already.
Oh, mm-hmm. This is great to know. Again, I never saw it in the nursing homes I was visiting with relatives over the years. I never saw any of that happening, but that doesn't mean it wasn't existing.
Well, they may be doing other forms of service learning, too, besides intergen, because it's not always intergen. You know, it may be gardening. It may be all kinds of areas that need help. You know, they may be working with the Red Cross or something else. But I'm sure there are probably some that do something in nursing homes. And if they in close proximity to a nursing home, it's even better. Some people, I've heard of places where the school is actually across the street from the nursing home and they weren't doing anything.
Yeah, that's like an opportunity being missed.
Right.
Okay, so if somebody is in a smaller community that maybe is not as far along in this process as the LA Unified, what should you go to, both the nursing homes and the schools, or do you have to start at the school level because they're the ones that have to buy in? Who has to buy in first?
Well, as I said, when I did it, of course, we always initiated the contact with the nursing home. But a lot of times, people will be interested if they're approached. So it's just because the nursing home. Sometimes the nursing homes don't have transportation, so they don't know how. Because it's a two-way thing. Sometimes we had people from the senior centers coming to the school. They had a van, but and then it may be difficult too because schools have to pay for the buses in many cases to get the children to the nursing home. So basically I would just approach the school that you think might be interested and talk to them about it. Because sometimes to save money, they can work on a project at school and then maybe present it. It may not require but maybe one or two trips to the nursing home. For example, when our students did biographies of the seniors, they made one trip, and on that trip they interviewed the seniors, ask them questions about their childhood, et cetera. And then they went back to the school, and that became an English project, and they wrote booklets for each resident you know, instead of having it written the way it had been in the question form for the interview, they wrote, you know, for example, my name is Alice Jones, I was born so-and-so, and they wrote the actual biography. And then those copies were made of that, and it was distributed in little booklets to everyone. So every resident at the nursing home received a little book, of a booklet of everybody else's biographies, because a lot of them in the nursing home don't really know a lot about one another, and that's important too, because everybody comes, I see so many similarities in the nursing homes and in schools, because people come to a nursing home, they have a history, and a lot of times that's forgotten, especially when the patients have dementia and can't tell you, I was a bank teller or I was president of such and such, and so their histories can be honored in that way.
One thing that I've been told by other people is that what you should recommend to a family is to print up a very short, couple paragraph story about the patient who's living home, because and then you keep it at the bedside in a frame, so everyone that's caring for that person can read their story. That they're not just a body in the bed,
right,
but they're somebody that mattered, that still matters to a family.
Right.
And
that's
a
great idea. That's a really a good idea. I like that.
Well, I really want to thank you for being here. I have learned so much, and I hope to continue learning from you. It's really been great talking to you.
I thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
Thank you. This is going to help so many people. If you would like more information about Becoming Dead Right, her wonderful book, or about her work, go to www.francisshaneyparker.com.
Right.
And for more help regarding other life and health issues you are struggling with, please visit my blog at kindethics.com. You can also ask me questions in the Ask Vicki section of my blog. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter under V-I-K-I-K-I-N-D. For those of you in the chat room, please leave any questions you have for me, and I will post my answers for you in my next blog. Thank you for listening, and have a kind and respectful day.